Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody. It's the American Allegiance Show, your host, Kevin White, all the way from downtown Heber Heights, Ohio. I am hosting a show tonight. I haven't been here for a week. I had to take last week off. I was out of town in Oklahoma City. Beautiful town. It's wonderful. It's boring a little bit. You know, it is what it is. But I am back this week with a good guest, a friend of mine, an attorney. Former DOJ attorney and now the founder of Former Feds, and he can explain that later. But I like to say things are looking up and the wrong way, and I'm talking about food prices. Have you guys been shopping lately? The fuel prices, the gas, meat? Listen, I'm not trying to be, you know, stereotypical, but I like chicken wings, and there's nothing wrong with that, right? Chicken wings. At my local Meijer, $17 for a pack. That's incredible. How cheap is it? How hard is it to catch a chicken? Well, that's beside the point. Everything is going the wrong way fast. So we're supposed to make a trip to Florida in December, and I'm trying to figure out whether we're going to be able to afford the gas at the rate that it's going right now. We know we have a fuel shortage, and I know Biden just released another 2 days worth of fuel surplus. I'm not sure if that's going to help any, but I guess every little bit helps in the mind of the Americans and the news and everything. In other news, Rittenhouse is free. Politics are not. If the video shows what it shows, that's what it is. That's our justice system. And I'd like to ask Mr. Geyer, Brad Geyer, who's my guest, about that a little bit. Maybe not. To work in the DOJ, so I'm sure he has a lot of experience. But anyway, let's get started with our guest, Mr. Brad Geyer. Mr. Geyer, are you on?
Hi, Kevin. How you doing tonight?
I'm doing great.
Great, me too. Things are. I like how you said things are looking up. They're looking up in terms of the price index, consumer price index, but I think they're also looking up just generally in a positive way.
Right. Right.
I don't want to be too Pollyannish, but just in terms of how things have been breaking regarding the mandatory vaccines, and we're beginning to get word out about. I have to turn off an alarm. Hold on 1 second. It's a terrible iPhone feature. There we go. We have our nonprofit, the former Feds Group Freedom Foundation at formerfedsgroup.org has our Remdesivir Survivors Group and Action Committee up and running. And we're getting the word out that nobody should be given Remdesivir in hospitals in the United States. I don't care what anybody says. And if anybody wants to challenge us on that, why don't we put up your experts against our experts? And we'll be happy to hash that out. It's a very, very dangerous drug. And it's probably contributed substantially to the death rate over the last 2 years. But we got that formed up, and that's a positive development. And we also had some positive developments on the January 6th defense. Namely, we're getting more meaty and substantial filings that are forcing the government to turn over information as required, and also hopefully to look at the information with a fresh set of eyes. I can certainly understand how early on it may have looked one way, particularly in the wake of substantial commentary by political leaders on all sides of the spectrum. And also by the media. But as the months have gone on, it's becoming more and more evident that there's a much more complex and nuanced interpretation from the facts that I've seen, at least. And of course, a lot of what I'm seeing is still, it remains under seal.
Very interesting. Totally un-American. The point of this show tonight is we have prisoners from January 6th, and I happen to know one of them personally, and I appreciate you coming on. But the point is, they have rights too as Americans. Even prisoners at Rikers Island, they get a free meal. The meal is fresh, and they're able to do things and communicate. Well, these prisoners haven't even had a trial yet, and they're stuck in there based on what happened January 6th, which was, they call it illegal and other things, but that's beside the point. The point is, what rights do they have, and what can we do to help them? And this is why I have, Beely, or Brad Geyer, on my show tonight, my buddy. I think this is your third appearance on my program in one way or another, so appreciate you being here and lending your expertise.
Yeah, so there's many January 6th defendants that are currently awaiting trial. They're in pretrial detention. Some years ago, they passed something known as the United States Bail Reform Act, and it really scrolled down the circumstances under which you could keep somebody detained. And the two primary factors that are considered are flight risk and also threat the defendant poses to the community. And, you know, as a class of defendants, surely these defendants, as a general rule, have clean or certainly mostly clean records. And you would think from that as a result of that, a lot of these people would have been released. But as it turns out, a lot of them were detained. As an example, my direct client, Kenneth Harrelson, who is a disabled, he's a veteran and a disabled veteran at that. He has a very clean background. He has basically no criminal history whatsoever. And he never even had a passport, aside from his military service where he did some state-sponsored travel. I don't think he ever went north of Georgia. So under most circumstances, you would take somebody like this and take some kind of bond, and that person would have been bailed, and he'd be perhaps under home confinement. But because of this event, and you know, I'm somewhat sympathetic, right? Because at the time, with all the overheated, bloviated press coverage that focused on a tiny little fraction of what actually happened over the course of the day, and because political representatives of both sides were pretty amped up, you would expect a response, perhaps a response that was maybe a little bit out of proportion. And I think that's, in fact, what we did get. And so we have in the Department of Corrections in Washington, D.C., there's a special unit set aside for these prisoners known as DCF. It's a reconditioned facility. It's an absolute hellhole of a place. Peeling paint, mold, air quality is terrible. Sewage comes out of the pipes and the water systems. They have an 8x12 cell with a desk. They are allowed to have family pictures. That's a plus. On top of that, and they get horrible food. The dinner might be a couple slices of bread, four slices of bread, and a couple of hard-boiled eggs. And as bad as that detention is, really imprisonment, up until a few months ago, they only got out of that 8x12 cell for about 1 hour a day because of COVID. Because when COVID came down, the Bureau of Prisons changed its policies and it really liberalized the rules under which people could be detained. You know, they had a hard time coping with COVID, particularly in the beginning. And so there was this looming presumption that was allowing people to get out. At the same time, you have these defendants who everybody had basically dehumanized and unpersoned as insurrectionists and traitors, which is absolutely false. There's absolutely nothing to support that. And so whether or not it was the cause of this policy change, there certainly seems to be a tight correlation with delegating all of the Bureau of Prisons, which, by the way, the Bureau of Prisons is in the Department of Justice. So this is a component of the U.S. Department of Justice. They delegated all their responsibilities for these prisoners to the District of Columbia, and they put them in this hellhole of a facility. They are fed poorly. They have the bare minimum in terms of what you would expect prisoners in the United States to be able to have access to. And to make it even worse, and to add insult to injury, 34 out of the 38 have chosen not to be vaccinated. Now, this is truly, there's a story here that is like for the ages, and ultimately somebody is going to be able to talk to these brave, courageous Americans who, you know, remember, they're only allowed out of their cells for 1 hour a day, and they were generally segregated during that time. So somehow these guys communicated to each other in a way where they determined, hey, you know what? Our lives have been totally ruined by this whole escapade. Who knows if we're ever going to be able to get out of here, if we're going to get a fair trial. The only thing that we can do is maybe put ourselves in the breach between these forces that are going to mandate forced medical experimentation on children and the children themselves. So from the moment they arrived, they refused to get the vaccine. Now, as I pointed out in our court filings, which can be found at formerfedsgroup.com, it was a voluntary medical experiment. In other words, you know, you have the freedom not to get the vaccine. But where the problem comes in under the various international laws, including Nuremberg and Helsinki protocols, as well as constitutional law under U.S. v. Griswold, and almost every single state, local, and federal law that's been passed since 1947, is that these prisoners, if they do not get the vaccine, they receive severe punishment. They can't get a haircut. They can't get a shave. Their movements within the prison are severely restricted. They are prohibited from engaging in any religious services or observances. They can't take communion, for instance. Okay? Well, so they have – yeah. And then on top of it, everybody inside this particular unit is treated specially. And that is that they have not laid the unvaccinated prisoners have not laid eyes on their loved ones since they were arrested and confined, because they are not able to have in-person visits, and they're not able to have video visits either. Forget about the whole thing about being able to prepare for trial and to engage in discovery. Like, that's been completely – that capability has been completely – destroyed. And because of this false narrative out there about them being insurrectionists and treasonous and racist and all this stuff, it's based on absolutely nothing. These are big lies. My client, for instance, was a member of the Oath Keepers. They have Black American Oath Keepers. My client serves in this prison proudly with a transgendered prisoner. Okay, so this whole idea, these guys, and by the way, every night at 8 p.m., they all sing the national anthem.
Awesome. It's
an absolute disgrace what's happening in this prison. And I frankly although I'm very hopeful because the prosecutors on the other side are, all, believe it or not, are really trying to be helpful, trying to turn over the information. They've really been proactive about it. And actually, you know, there have been instances where they find something that they know is very beneficial to the defense, and they send it to us in a direct email, which I am eternally grateful for. These guys are class acts, and, of course, it's Department of Justice prosecutors, so they're always going to comply with, you know, the highest degree of ethical conformance. And we're also, in my particular case, we're also very lucky with having Judge Maida. He's just a terrific judge, and it's an honor to be in his courtroom. But these are largely systemic problems that arrived before the case was even charged.
Now let me ask you a question before you go any further. I mean, everybody knows, I told everybody you're a former DOJ attorney, and this is part of the DOJ, and you have a defendant there, and the other side, your prosecutors know that this is wrong, apparently, but it seems like everything's pushing off onto the people who run the jail, the prison. You would think that they put a stop to this already. You would think this is not America. This is not American values. This is not constitutional. How are they getting away with it? Why can't somebody go in there and it's been a long time. Like, my friend that was arrested, that was on January 6th, but she wasn't arrested until July 18th. You know, that's a pretty long time.
Right.
And she has, like, I can attest to what you're saying, because her husband has not seen her. He just got a neck surgery when she was taken, and she just got over cancer. I mean, I talked to them the day before they left, because they were asking if I was going to go. I said, nah, you know, it's too cold for a brother to go there in that time of the weather anyway, time of year. But
right.
I said, you know, you guys be careful. And there's nothing. And her husband was right next to her, or right in front of her. They didn't arrest him. She had a Q sign. They had pictures up. That's the picture they show when they show her profile. And the only evidence they got her on.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, they make so much of that.
And by the way, this doesn't make any sense, because her husband was right in front of her, but he didn't have a sign like that. He's never been arrested. And I think she was targeted, and they were together. So something's not right about what's going on. I fear for I fear this is a very scary situation for the rest of us, if they can do that to those people.
Yeah, what you're touching on, Kevin, is that, I'm just one man's opinion, right? But the first thing I noticed, and I came on, I believe it was the second week of September, so I'm a newbie. But the first thing I noticed is it seemed like there was a lot of criminalization of First Amendment protected conduct, both freedom of association, freedom of expression. If you look at the Oath Keepers indictment, for instance, and we laid this out in, I guess it was the first renewed pretrial release motion. If you're looking at the press releases on the front page of formerfedsgroup.com, if you click on that, I believe it's the third one down. And the indictment spends a lot of time talking about, you know, things like what the Oath Keepers wore, and that it can, I mean, the entire thing is built around this idea that these guys are all like, you know, militia yahoos, insurrectionists, who should be thrown in prison, if not for what's in the indictment, for other reasons. You know, it's like the whole thing is prejudicial. They spend so much time on what these guys wore. They give like descriptions as you know, it's like I'm reading Vogue magazine or something, or like, you know, I'm on the red carpet with Joan Rivers or something. It's just that struck me as strange. They also refer the Oath Keepers, if you remember the background in which they got started, at least the part that I'm familiar with that relates to my client, is that in the prior year they were having these events, Trump rallies, other events, and the local you know, we live in a world where everything has become politicized, and traditionally running security for events was never politicized. You would get, if you were a Democrat or you were a Republican, everybody, it was public safety was an area that nobody played those kinds of games with. And what happened in the year leading up to January 6th is that these, a lot of local government to state government started starving these events of security resources. And there were some events that occurred where it was like remarkable how little security they had, and yet nothing really happened because everybody was pretty much law-abiding. But it was nonetheless a security concern. So it put people who were attending the events into the position of thinking, well, gee, maybe we have to do something privately. So the Oath Keepers are one of the organizations that just went in and started providing ad hoc security at these events. And there are two kinds of – they did a lot of different things, from standing and guarding businesses that were in the path of, you know, marauding, you know, looters and arsonists. You know, that actually happened. But the thing they would do at the rallies a lot are usher dignitaries up to the stage. You know, you have to get through a crowd. And there's a way that they would do that. They would, you know, go in a line, one behind another. And particularly in places where there was a lot of activity, people were compressed, or it was loud, you would put your hand on the person in front of you as a way to communicate to the person in front of you that you haven't been lost. And the dignitary generally would go towards the rear middle, and towards the end would be sort of an anchor person who would do cleanup and make sure that nobody got left behind. And by moving in that way, you can move through a crowd much, much more quickly. If you've ever been waiting for Splash Mountain at Disney World or Blizzard Beach or going into, a concert, you know, and you're with five or six people, do you walk abreast or do you walk one behind another and let the person in front of you find an opening and then you follow them? So the reason I'm going through this convoluted and long explanation is they spend such a long time on it in the indictment, and they refer to it as them traveling in a stack up the congressional steps. Now, keep in mind, my client, Harrelson, he was dressed in a T-shirt and a ball cap and happened to not be wearing any Oath Keepers clothing that would be identified with the Oath Keepers. And by the way, one of the reasons you wear identifying clothing is so people say, oh, it's the Oath Keepers. They kind of have an official purpose. Let's get out of their way. If they give us a direction, we should follow directions. There's a reason why they dressed the way they did, and it was related to public safety. So if you go and you just – I encourage your listeners to just go into Google and type the words military stack, STACK, into Google Images and see what you find. And you're going to find 100 photos of groups of military guys in a tight-knit group in uniform, all who have semi-automatic weapons. And so for whatever reason, the whoever was drafting the indictment that my client is charged under, they spent a lot of time adorning the defendants in this militaria, this militia type thing. This they use terms like storming, they use terms like breaching the door, and as we point out in some of our responses, the door that the Oath Keepers went through, they had no part in breaching. In fact, it wasn't breached. It was open from the inside. You know, this is an example. If I were to tell you that a military stack of Oath Keepers wearing military garb breached the building, and you were to imagine that in your mind, you were to picture that in your mind, and then if I went and I showed you the actual videotapes, most of which is under seal, okay? This is under seal, so I can explain it, but I can't show it to you. so I can explain to your listeners that that door that the U.S. that the government is saying was breached, it turns out it was the door was open from the inside. And then, to my chagrin, if you look at the first footnote or the second footnote in it's ECF 485, I learned this about an hour before I filed from BuzzFeed, of all things, that an hour to 90 minutes before the Oath Keepers walked through the door, literally when you see the videotape, you will not even believe it. There's a crowd that basically comes through the door, and, you know, I'm not going to – when you see the video, you'll – you know, everybody can draw their own conclusions. I don't have to. Everybody has common sense. But I learned an hour before I filed this from BuzzFeed that I want to say hundreds, but I don't want to exaggerate. I'll say over 100 protesters were welcomed in by Capitol Police in other locations around the Capitol. Now, this is outrageous, yeah. Right? Because when you look at how they charged this case under 1512, it's the first time they've ever used 1512, which, lo and behold, has a 20-year – it's a 20-year statute, right? And so if you get charged with this statute, you're in for 20 solid years of time. And what it is basically obstruction of an official proceeding, and it was passed – with Dodd-Frank and all this, financial crimes. And it really, everybody up until this novel use of it was in agreement that it really related to official proceedings, like investigative proceedings of Congress. That's when it was like where they're handing out compulsory process, where there's somebody presiding as a chair, almost as a judge, where people are, you know, it's – it was this very narrow piece of all the activities of Congress. And why when you look at the congressional record, they, of course, have the exact – everyone had the exact concerns that I have now and had the same concerns in mind, because it's so obvious that it's running right up against the First Amendment, freedom of association, freedom of speech, freedom of you know, being able to engage in ribald political expression. These are things that are ingrained in our system. Our whole system has been built around this. And they're totally changing the rules as they applied up until about 2 years ago. So they take this 1512, they make novel use of it, and they basically say, well, you obstructed a proceeding. What they leave out is that at the time the Oath Keepers had walked in, basically, the Congress had already been gaveled out of session because there were bomb threats. Do you remember the bomb threats, Kevin?
Yes.
And,
yes, I do.
And when these bomb threats came in, of course, everybody rightfully said, we got to basically evacuate everybody. So there was no proceeding to obstruct. So at the time these guys walked in, the government saying they breached the door, they didn't breach the door. They walked in, it was open from the inside, probably from invitees that were invited in from other parts of the Capitol. When they walked in, there was no official proceeding to obstruct. But it's even worse than that. Because what they did is they basically – the
You still there?
To quote on.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead. I got you.
Basically, like besmirches anybody who was inside the Beltway that day, based on essentially an aiding and abetting theory. As best I can tell, it's an aiding and abetting theory. They accuse my clients of having damaged property. And if they're going to say, well, it wasn't the breach, then they're going to say it was property somewhere else in the Capitol, right? And
right.
In order to do that, they had to obstruct the proceeding corruptly. And corruptly has a term of art. It's a specific intent crime, primarily used in like financial crimes and things like that. And what they did is they even went further. They bastardized the interpretation even worse by saying that the corruptly can refer to general crimes, like, I suppose, vandalism. And, of course, vandalism is what gives a presumption of detention. So even though, the government's pretty much said that your client hasn't engaged in any, you know, my client didn't. And when your listeners watch the video, because when it's, I follow the court's directions to the letter. And I will, any court protective order, I abide by 101%. But as soon as that is, the protective order is lifted in this or another case, perhaps, and that information comes out, your listeners are going to be able to see exactly what happened. You're going to see them at the front of the Capitol. And you can see my client. He has a cell phone. It's held aloft over his head, and you can see with your own eyes that his cell phone, which is 3 feet above his head and not blocked by many, many bodies, did not pick up any breaking of a door or breaking of a glass or anything strange going on deep at the front by the front door. And then you will see from the inside, you will see somebody come from another part of the building and open the door. And before he opens the door, it's opened twice. The first time it's opened, he tries to hit it with his shoulder, and he can't open it. And I'm not going to explain why, because there's an issue there that I think it would be fine for me to explain, but I'm not 100% sure, so I'm going to leave it alone. He takes a few steps back, turns around and looks up at an elevated point. I'm suspecting that there's somebody who was Capitol staff who would have to open the door. And it may turn out that there was a reason why they opened the door, because people were getting compressed. You see this as a theme throughout, that it was really understaffing, and they really had very poor crowd control. And there are various times when nobody was in control, whether it's the Capitol or people who happen to have the unfortunate experience of being there. And so from the inside, you see him look up, and it looks like, again, I'm inferring here, but it looks to me like somebody discharged the door. He went and opened it. By the way, that initial group has no identifiable MAGA gear on. So the initial group that I see did not appear to me to have MAGA gear on. And of the initial eight, I believe two appear. They don't have MAGA gear on, but they have two. They do have two flags. But no one has MAGA gear on, as best of my recollection. Then I believe, as best I could tell, that door was closed. And then I believe it's opened a second time. This time, there's interaction and participation with police. The door is open from the inside. And at this point, people start coming in. And I think that people were letting people in, and this included the police, because there was a public safety issue just in terms of the lack of control. People were getting too compressed. You see this happening in other places. People start coming through, and then you see my client come through. He's got his phone up, and he's basically, there's people behind him. He's basically like pushed through. He walks into the initial area. He then goes into the rotunda. You can tell he's looking up. He's just overcome by the majesty of the rotunda,
right?
And
yeah,
I think it was a moving experience for everybody. But it looks like, Kevin, it looks like people walking in a crowded museum. And then
right,
you see him, he starts to walk out a couple times, He's I think he sees, maybe he sees like he's in a moment there or whatever. He kind of circles back. And then the oath keepers actually get down on their knees and say a prayer. And you can see that on the videotape. Okay.
I got a question for you before you go any further.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. That the fact that the door was open from the inside, doesn't matter, you know, if there's crushing or anything, tells me it was a setup. It seems like it's a setup. We're going to do this. We're going to bring him in. Because otherwise, if the security was that critical, they wouldn't let you in.
I'm not willing to say that yet, Kevin.
Okay.
I want to be as objective and open-minded as I can be.
Gotcha.
There's a lot of reasons why there would have been – I'll just give you one example, right? Like, I think it's pretty clear that if they would have been able to have better, more security early, it would have gone a long way because clearly when you look at the perimeter, it was sparsely sparsely guarded. And it,
right, but they turned down the National Guard. That's the problem.
Yes.
That was their security.
Well, and you have a great point there. Yeah. What I'll say is there's a complicated story there, and there's a lot of players involved, and I'm not ready to start trying to attribute intent or motivation yet. What I do know is that the door the Oath Keepers came through, they did not breach it. That is I believe it's a mistaken word to use in relation to what happened. People opened the door from the inside.
You know more than all of us in the audience know, so I'm taking your word for that. Thank you very much.
No. Look, you're entitled to your opinion. Your opinion could very well be more informed than mine. Make no mistake about it. For me, in the context of a criminal defense, there would be multiple people looking at that, and we would need multiple discovery requests.
No problem. No, I understand.
Yeah. So it's, I'm not, I don't want to be too hard on my esteemed colleagues on the other side of the table from me because, to date, they've been very, I mean, aside from the charges themselves and the, unwillingness to let my client out, who's never been a threat to anybody, which we professionally disagree. We have good relations. I like to keep it that way. And as to what I would say about that comment, Kevin, is that I've seen things that concern me in terms of breaches, like legitimate breaches into the Capitol through broken windows, for instance, where some of the people doing it, it's not obvious to me that they were genuinely there for the protest. They don't have any identifiable gear on. There's actually one video I've seen where they almost look like ninjas. But I don't want to draw too much from that. You know, the Capitol is about the size of a large cruise ship with many doors. And one of the challenges is trying to figure out, you know, when everything was so distorted in the days that followed the event, because you had every single politician with every single stripe running out there and making comments about what happened that in some cases, some of it was accurate, but in a vast majority of cases wasn't. And it's very hard to undo that. You know, the fact that insurrection never crossed my client's mind, I'm absolutely certain of it. I know that, you know, in my heart of hearts. And I know that my client is legal, you know, both as the fact that he's, you know, you're innocent until proven guilty. Yes, I mean it in that sense. But this is unusual for me because in when I'm saying it here, I really mean it that he's innocent. my client, Kenneth Harrelson, is innocent. And, you know, I believe that when a jury of his peers in Washington, D.C., when they're properly selected and they're presented with the evidence, they're going to come to the same conclusion. But yeah, there's a lot more that we need to learn about why it was that there was that the security was so sparse. And then I'm gonna give you a little bit of a preview about what I've learned just in the last, this would be the last week and a half, I would say. There's a distinction between Capitol Police and the Metro Police Department. And one of the things that happened, and I don't have the evidence in front of me yet. I'm going based on fragmentary information, but it's fragmentary information that continues to disturb me. I think MPD came in, and I think they may have had a different mindset and a different aggression level. And I have seen a lot of video where the crowd is being provoked in ways that I have a hard time rationalizing or justifying. And most notably, I was very disturbed to see last week, and we made this a subject of our most recent motion to release this, that there's a white-shirted Metro Police Department officer. My understanding is that the officers, the leadership, wears a white shirt. And somebody made the decision, we'll have to, you know, somebody who understands rules of engagement and crowd control better than me will have to make a determination as to whether this was appropriate or not. To me, it seems like it wasn't. But they essentially did a piercing movement out of that west tunnel. And what happened was it compressed everybody and caused a massive public safety issue. People got stomped and people got beaten and people got maced and pepper sprayed and everything else. And one person was beaten so bad that she died. Now there's a pathology report that is not public, and it apparently seems to suggest that she died of a drug overdose. But I've personally seen videotape of her being beaten by a female officer with a baton. And even worse than that, what's even clearer to me, and this just really, it still bothers me because it's inconsistent. And I was in law enforcement for 21 years. I have the highest respect and regard for, I mean, no one bought more, I have the highest respect for law enforcement. This one white-shirted officer in the tunnel is put such a beating on this, she's a MAGA-hatted female. I would say she's in her early 30s. She's wearing she has a white hoodie over her head with a red MAGA cap over it. If I had to guess, I would say she's about 5'5", 5'6". And she's compressed up sort of like against the wall in the tunnel, and nobody can move. And her arms are like down at her sides. Like imagine being compressed and you can't get your arms up. And there's a white-shirted MPD officer who is beating the living you know what out of her with a collapsible club. And when I say beating her, I mean beating her repeatedly and incessantly on top of her head over and over and over. And when the hat comes off, because he beats the hat off of her head, her white hoodie has blood splotches all over it from her scalp.
Oh, man, no way. In this country, that sounds like something I've seen overseas. This is insane. This is insane.
Joseph McBride, who's just terrific legal counsel. We're kind of going back and forth in the timeline because we just couldn't believe what we were seeing. And he also uses his fist, and he's throwing punches at her face. which he can't go anywhere. Then he takes his baton and he's like spearing her with it, spearing her face and the back of her head with it. And how this person, I mean, I don't recall ever seeing anything about an investigation and prosecution of an MPD officer that was in the West Tunnel. Do you?
No.
I mean, I don't see anything. And to me, when people see this, they're going to be outraged, absolutely outraged, because of course the people that, and there's a story about how that whole conflagration occurred. And let me just say, it's going to people who believe the narrative as it's been presented up to this point are going to be very, very surprised, if not shocked.
That's incredible. I don't understand. I mean, this is not the country I live in. I mean, it's turning to that, but things like this are very disturbing. And the fact that I know somebody there, I personally know this person. I don't know what's going on, you know, in the cells and everything, mentioned before. And I, you know, people can't handle it. This is just, her husband is a decorated Navy and Air Force veteran. They're very patriotic. They go around, you know, Ohio speaking and attended events. And he's a pilot and everything. I used to work with him for years. And this is what she gets? Really? She's the nicest woman the nicest I've ever met. And this is ridiculous. I mean, she is not part of any group or anything. She was just there because that was her right to be there.
Freedom of association, freedom of expression, freedom to protest. Though, you know, these were rights that, I remember, Kevin, and I think you may be a little bit younger than me, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe you're just well preserved. But I remember back in the 1970s, late 1970s, when you would have the ACLU and they would go out and defend all the Nazis that were marching in Skokie, Illinois.
Right.
And
I remember that.
And you remember how that gave us like this lesson on First Amendment, the power of the First Amendment. Like, I'm not going to, you know, I disagree with everything you say, but I'm going to stand shoulder to shoulder with you regarding your right to say it. And a lot of that, for a whole variety of reasons, no longer exists. It's almost like that's a prior time in our history. But I'd like to think that Constitution is a shining beacon on the hill, and it's just as strong as it's ever been. It's just, you know, ready to be, you know, dusted off and deployed appropriately in courts of law. And that's what I think we're going to be seeing. As you know, the vast majority, 95%+, 99%+, 99 with a decimal point percent, were law-abiding. There were probably over 1 million people there that day, right? So,
right.
It's, you know, with social media platforms being the way that they are, and as controlling and as censorship-driven as they are, and as mainstream media being such that it is, and just giving one myopic presentation of facts, and then being in the shadow of Congress, you know, the court that we're in is in the shadow of Congress. The judges look out their window, and they see all these fences around and all this security, and they would only, you know,
I think we lost you for a second.
People who were there on January 6th, and whether or not you can get a fair trial in the district, I'd like to think you can. But you know, we're taking a careful look at that. It may be too tall of an order, even for one of the best districts in the country in terms of. I mean, you can't find a better district for juries than Washington, D.C. But it just may be too tall of an order. We may have to take a look at maybe going to some other venues.
Right. I can understand that.
It's just amazing how it's a whole other world. That prison is its own country, it seems like. And I do understand Washington, D.C. is not our – maybe that's how they can get away with it, because it's not actually the United States. It's the District of Columbia. I mean, I don't understand what kind of jurisdiction, you know, these people have, the guards and everything. This is like they have more power than everybody
right.
else in Washington now.
Well, in regards to the decision not to get vaccinated, you know, all the vaccines in the United States today are experimental. And what they did, they're all under EUA. And what they did is they announced in cahoots with public health agencies, they announced that Pfizer's Comirnaty had been formally approved.
Right. Yeah.
But that can't be that is not in the United States. And the reason it's not in the United States is if they brought Comirnaty into the United States, it would invalidate all the existing EUAs. So nobody else would be able to sell their EUA vaccines. So what they do is really dastardly, in my opinion. They say, well, the Pfizer vaccine is identical to Comirnaty, so you can just kind of assume that it's the same, you know, the same thing. And yet, they also say, but it's different, because that's what gives the justification to sell the Pfizer under the EUA. And then if you look at the ingredients, all the vaccine manufacturers suppress certain ingredients that are in the vaccine. So I believe that at some point in the future, they're going to look back at all of this mischief in attempting to revoke informed consent. I mean, informed consent since 1947 has been the law of the land regarding all medical experimentation. And in the last 2 years, the country just careened over the side of a, you know, into a ditch
right.
by pretending that an OLC, Department of Justice opinion, and EUA charging legislation could undo 80 years of, is it 80 years? No, not quite.
It's like 77 years, yeah.
Many years, let's say, many decades of informed consent being the law of the land. And, of course, the reason informed consent was the law of the land is because in 1947, we were on the heels of the worst war that had ever occurred in world history, and we'd all gotten through the genocide, and we got through those Nazi doctors that were doing all these experiments on children in the prison camps and everywhere else, engaging in euthanasia, engaging in cold water experiments with concentration camp prisoners. And so those very enlightened, there was a combination of the military tribunal judges and the prosecutors. They all kind of got together and came up with these 10 protocols that are absolutely timeless. And because they were so timeless and perfect, all of Western nations research involving human subjects. I mean, literally thousands and thousands and thousands of interweaves involving our entire tapestry of rule of law. And then the last 2 years, it was allegedly undone. And so what I say to physicians, and because I see a perfect storm, really, this revocation of informed consent is not going to hold up. And these attempted indemnifications and immunities that are being conferred, most often not in writing, these physicians that now, when they want to go and use ivermectin, but they're concerned that they're going to lose their indemnification under the PrEP Act, they're going to be penalized with CMS calculations, they're going to lose their pharmacy board seats, they're going to lose their medical board seats, they're going to lose their hospital privileges, they're going to lose their They're going to be investigated by the state. They're going to lose board seats. When right now, as a practical matter, because physicians are just as much a victim of this as anybody, as you or I are.
I agree.
And right now, when they look at it, it's a solid wall of that makes it, as a practical matter, almost impossible to give that patient ivermectin, something that works.
You know what's sad about this
is with remdesivir. Say it again.
Right. You know what's sad about that? Doctors don't work for people anymore. They work for institutions. They work for hospitals. They work for the government. That's the sad thing about it. I mean, this should be just like they do in Africa. They don't have those problems, and they just give everybody, you know, ivermectin or something else.
Yes.
And it's working. So go ahead.
Yes.
And I want to let the audience know that Brad Geyer is also an expert on this virus and the medications and everything. He know the first show he was on, I mean, he ruled it all out, laid it all out. So go ahead, sir.
Yeah, so, well, and it's not – I piggyback off of the true experts like
okay.
Dr. Robert Malone and Dr. Peter McCullough. And there's a host of people who are the frontline doctors, Dr. Emanuel, Dr. Gold, Dr. Urso, Dr. Malik, Dr. Barrick. I could go on and on. These are true heroes, and ultimately, you know, they're all going to be in contention for Nobel Prizes.
Absolutely.
If you take remdesivir, and we're going to be doing a white paper on remdesivir. It's an absolutely deadly killer drug. Nobody ever thought it worked. It was in August of 2019. It was pulled by a compassionate use board because it was killing Nigerian kids. Somehow this Gilead product becomes the go-to drug, the first line of defense against COVID, even though it can only be administered through IV, which as a practical matter means you have to be admitted to hospital. Now why would they pick an only IV drug for that doesn't work for COVID? Because I believe that at that earliest stage, they were hell-bent on getting EUA authorities for these risky mRNA vaccines. And the fact that it remdesivir doesn't work and actually kills people was a feature, not a flaw. And so when you look at the research, and again, eventually when the world recovers from this, it's got diminished capacity right now. But when we come out of this and we go back and we look at the research studies that were done around hydroxychloroquine, I'm talking about you, Lancet. When we're looking at how we're looking at the framing of these studies, where they just used hydroxychloroquine alone without a cofactor like zinc, when they restricted the studies to late use, when they actually overdosed patients, I'm talking to you, doctors in the UK, and was it Brazil or Portugal? I forget. Who are overdosing patients and saying, whoopsie, when at some point in the future, after all the investigations have been conducted, all this is going to come to light, and whatever indemnifications or immunities that you know, they thought they had, enforcement agencies of the future are going to be taking a very severe look at this conduct and turn, of course, next.
With the healthcare, you're cutting it out here and there.
Damn sure that their patients are giving informed consent. Quite frankly, I think it's almost impossible to even get informed consent because of so much deception and everything else that's been going on around this issue. It's going to be really difficult, because what will end up happening is right now somebody looking at it says, well, there's 12 reasons why I can't go off label, go off PrEP Act, and use ivermectin. But what ends up happening is as time goes on, evidence of that kind of just evaporates. And when you're looking at back at it in 3 years or 4 years or 5 years, those things that those conditions that were, you know, real as they could be in November of 2021 have a way of evaporating. You can look at the savings and loan debacle. All those savings and loans, all those executive management teams, all those outside contractors, all those boards of directors, all those banks that were doing that, they all got legal opinions that said it was legal. And you know what? It was legal until they said it wasn't. Everybody got prosecuted. So too with Enron. All those shell companies that they were doing transactions through and engaged in different fee shifting schemes and profit shifting schemes and tax abatement schemes and all these things. All of those transactions were approved by the top legal minds in the country. And they were totally perfectly legal. What Ken Lay was doing and Enron was doing was perfectly legal until it was no longer legal. Right? And so
right.
The concern I have, and this is one of the reasons why we've been drafting an amnesty program for physicians and treating nurses and also leniency programs for everybody else, is because we see a dynamic developing over the next couple of years where treating physicians are being set up to basically hold the bag. And that's terrible because the vast majority of physicians have, you know, the way the system works is they're in the trenches doing the treating, and
right.
They should have the ability to rely on a protocol that is transmitted to them by public health agencies that have taken an oath to preserve and protect the Constitution and everything else. And how could they possibly know that protocol to use remdesivir is actually the thing that's dramatically adversely impacting their patient's health and in many cases killing them? I mean, it's a lot to have somebody believe that our public health agencies have become that corrupt. But, you know, I think the evidence is out there that they have.
So I'm glad you're doing what you're doing because, I mean, that's what they need. It's sad and unfortunate that's the way things have to go. But, you know, I mean, that's what we have to do these days. By the way, I have a couple of callers. Would you like to answer some questions?
Great.
Okay. Okay, we have a caller from Erica 304. That's West Virginia. Hello, caller. Welcome to the show. You there?
Hey, Gary, how are you? Not Gary. Are you there?
Oh, yeah, we're here.
Yes, I'm here. Go ahead.
Okay. Hey, how are you guys doing tonight?
We're doing well. Thank you.
I don't know why I said Gary to begin with. Sorry about that.
Okay. No, don't worry about it.
Kevin, I think one of his posts came up in my news feed when you took me off mute, and I just automatically said it because I was reading what he was writing. Sorry, dude.
It's all good.
Okay.
You know,
I'm impossible to insult at this point. Trust me.
Hey, they try to insult. I can't be insulted. I'm no Karen.
So, caller, tell us what questions you have for a guest?
Well, since I just tuned in, I'm not quite sure what all is going on for tonight. So why don't you tell me what it's about, and I will ask a question.
The January 6th.
Well, what I would say is that January 6th and also anything vaccine-related.
Anything vaccine-related? Well, I'm not an anti-vaxxer. but I have not gotten the vaccine. I did have COVID, and the only thing, which really sucks because it's still going on, is I lost my taste and smell. Thank the good Lord above, I did not end up with pneumonia. I did not get sick at all. My family, husband and daughter, both got it. Same thing with them, but they kept their taste and smell. Had I been given the information on the, what they call the MAB, the infusion, more than likely would have not taken it because the side effects that I had afterwards for several days were horrid. My heart wasn't beating right. My blood pressure was awful. My kidneys were killing me.
Wow.
And had I known before, I wouldn't have taken that. And all these vitamins that they are pushing right now on the market for you to take, especially the ones made by Spring Valley, your basic Walmart, okay, they're all made in China. I quit taking
them.
And I felt so much better after I stopped taking
them. Too.
Yeah, I stopped taking them, and I feel better now than I did before. And I was taking them before I ever got the virus. And
well, I'm not a physician.
I feel better now.
I'm not a physician, and I know a little bit about supply chain in that industry, the supplement industry, and also pharmaceuticals. And everything that I say, you know, you should get a physician you should be taking medical advice from a physician. But the bottom mm-hmm. line is that, in my opinion, there was a cure. There were multiple cures from the very outset. What clued me into there being that there was something nefarious going on was everybody got very strange when somebody said the C word, the cure word, and
mm-hmm.
it flowed through to the social media platforms. So a lot of the earliest censorship by Facebook, which at the time was trying to ingratiate itself with monopoly enforcers and also anybody at the FCC that would want to revoke its liability protection, its libel protections. That was one of the first areas that they were going after, was any references to there being a cure, because of course they were desperate to protect that the capacity to get EUAs for these mRNA vaccines. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, talk to your physician. There's a lot of physicians out there. I'm not your guy, but there's the MAP protocol. There's all kinds of protocols
right.
by licensed physicians. They're still using hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin. Dr. Zelenko, if you're in New Jersey, it would be worth the drive to go see Dr. Zelenko. He's a true hero.
Yes, he is. I agree.
And frankly,
I've
been
doctor.
On 400 milligram.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
My doctor,
who
has a child with cancer, who's 6 years old, she did get vaccinated, but at the same time, because I have lupus, she told me it was probably, you know, when this first came out, she said it's probably not a very good idea because my numbers were right at that 1,000 mark, which means it's not high enough to medicate me, but my immune system is on overload. So we opted
Were you taking hydroxychloroquine for the lupus?
No, I take nothing.
Okay.
My numbers
well,
are not high enough to take anything. Mine is just on the outside. It's on my skin. So I opted not to do the Plaquenil or prednisone, which is what the one doctor had opted for me to take. And I said, okay, how about long sleeves and sunscreen? And I refused the medication. And I've been in remission now for almost 16 years.
That's great.
Just by doing my own thing and not taking drugs.
That's I believe the same thing. All right, caller, thank you. We're going to go to our next caller. Our next caller is from, Indiana. Welcome, caller, to the American Legion Show.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing great.
Good evening.
All right. I got a couple quick questions, really. On January 6th, when they went in, would their rights just be basically automatically sitting on the curb because they're not supposed to be in there? Granted, if the door was open, it'd be kind of an invitation. I can understand that. If people scanning the walls now, they would be a different story, I would imagine, wouldn't they?
Yeah, so I'm not going to get into the defense, but just hypothetically, there are the Capitol grounds, and you can imagine the perimeter, and it goes around, I don't know how many acres it is, but it's a big physical plant. And technically, the government's position seems to be that if you went onto those government grounds, you were trespassing. And everything that happens after that positions you to be selected out for some kind of legal action. So you'll see, and I haven't done any extensive study. That's one of the actually things I want to have commission done is to do a study on all the different cases and where people were and what the circumstances were and all that stuff. And at some point we'll do that. We're not there yet. But for instance, there was one, I remember there was an agent perhaps who was like outside of the curtilage. And I think he was standing at the base of a statue or something and he was charged. Whereas, you know, many people who went into the Capitol didn't end up being charged. So it seems like the government, their position is that once you went onto the property, you were trespassing. And then it seems like they drew another distinction at going into the physical building or the outbuildings. That puts
almost
you in another risk category. And by the way, looking at it objectively, all that makes, you know, makes sense. I mean, they're trying to be proportional. They're trying to be reasonable. And they're trying to, you know, they don't want to, I don't know how many people were there, but it was probably tens of thousands. They probably want to charge all those people even less than we want those people to be charged, right? It's like it would be impossible to manage all that. It's already very difficult for them to manage what they have. So I think that they, using that as a methodology for charging, it seems reasonable. However, where I think things got maybe a little bit askew is it seems to me that, first off, the fact that a facility is secured, that can be taken to mean a lot more than what it really means. I mean, the National Aerospace Museum is secured 24 hours a day, but, you know, millions of people or certainly hundreds of thousands of people go through that facility every year. And Congress, even during the day, is open to the public. They have a cafeteria. People like to go to the cafeteria and have lunch. And, you know, they look for VIPs. And, you know, it's a nice experience to have in Washington, D.C. People stroll around the Capitol grounds. It's not, you know, it's not unusual. But it was sort of like they just decided that anybody that stepped across that line did so with the requisite mental intent. And if you can imagine, the analogy that I draw is if you've ever been in a bar and a big section of the bar hasn't been opened because that shift hasn't arrived yet that would allow you to open up that section of the bar. And the smaller section of the bar is like jammed cheek to jowl with people, and the other part of the bar is still closed down. There might be only like some chairs that keep that side closed off. The new staff shows up, they move a chair, and that crowd will go and fill the space. And I think that that's most people, that explains what happened. They saw people moving in the direction.
I've played a couple bars that I can understand as that part.
right, yeah. So, or say like a concert where, or a good example is, have you ever been, I thought of this, the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids exhibit in Disney World. Everybody's like jammed up, and everybody knows it because you've been in line for a while and you've seen the doors open and close three or four times before you get there. And you know that the game is to get through the door fast and then get sort of like towards the center where, you know, everything's set up to be the sweet spot. And when those doors open, everybody just immediately fills the void, right? They do it with dispatch. And so you had a situation like, for instance, at the Stagecoach entrance where there were some bike racks and there was sparse guard activity, and a couple people moved some of these bike racks from perpendicular to parallel, and they started walking through, and then people just started following them. Now, the government seems to think, if it's not just beyond just presence, that everybody that walked across that line knew that they were walking across the line and knew they were breaking the law. But most people there thought everything had been opened up for the day. For a good part of the day, it was like a festival environment. You know, you can't...
Was it set up with posted signs of no trespassing in that area?
Not that I'm aware of. And if anybody finds that, please send it to me because I've been asking for it. No, I mean, what I've heard from people who are walking around was, look, everybody just didn't walk in. Make no mistake about it. And everybody didn't just walk into the Capitol, right? There were some people that broke windows and people that did really, really bad things.
And
they should be held accountable, you know. But the vast majority of people had no... didn't have that kind of intent that they were violating the law by mere presence.
I can understand that, yes. That makes sense.
Yes, they kind of, I guess, railroaded. Is the word I was looking
for. I think there are some that's, like, I happen to believe that my client is, I mean, that's the expression we use outside the courtroom. But I earnestly believe that they just got it wrong. And I know how those mindsets are set. I know how that, you know, I used to be in that business. And I know how you, and it's human and it's I can understand it. I can understand the process and I forgive it to a great extent. But I forgive it to a great extent with the proviso that no matter how hard it is, when it comes time to look at it with fresh eyes, that they're not going to just dig their heels in on the old view that isn't really what happened. I can understand, you know, when they were doing all these cases, they would have been under incredible pressures, like pressures that, you know, when I think back on it, you know, makes me glad I'm no longer in government, right? And government has extraordinarily good quality control. So to set up that kind of an operation, you got to really be at the top of your game, and you got to have the best agents, and everybody's got to be super organized. And but you can just adjust some facts a little bit and just add some, you know, put some benign quantities in for variables, and it can very easily change the outcome. So that what's more of an art than a science is trying to come up with presenting your case. And part of that, unfortunately, is the media's job.
Yeah, words can paint a lot. Make a visual.
Thank you, caller. Part of the job.
Thanks, caller. We appreciate your comments. And see you next week. Come back in and see what we're talking about. And I appreciate your call. Thank you.
Oh, I love the show. I'll be tuned back in. You can count on it.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Have a good one.
All right. So one thing you mentioned about the crowds, you know, and I know I work on a government facility, and, you know, I was in the military, and there are something places you can't go, but usually they're well marked and things you can't do, especially for the public. And the thing that makes me kind of upset is that that's our building. I understand what happened, but that building belongs to us. And it seems like it's government versus the prisoners, the full force of the government versus citizens that were there peacefully. And, I mean, you can't blame the crowd. I mean, you can blame the crowd and what happens to everybody else, all the other people. But it seems like this is going a little too far, especially when you don't arrest people who burn down cities or people who or somebody who plows through a crowd in Kishwa, where it is, Wisconsin, and then you let them free 2 hours later. That doesn't make any sense. And nobody had guns, nobody died except for the people, or Mrs. Babbitt, and that was done by somebody else. So I don't understand what the big hype is, and I'm sure you're going to get to the bottom of this. But I wanted to ask you another question. I was looking up what you were talking about earlier, and I saw you appear in the American Thinker. Did you see that? You're noted for January 6th thing. I don't know if you're familiar with that. So you made...
No, I didn't see that.
I'll send you a link for that. I think that's awesome.
Oh, thank you.
Your name is... That's pretty cool. And I understand...
Oh, wow. No,
isn't that amazing? And I know that...
Yeah, no,
the,
I actually read American... I read American Thinkers, so I'm thrilled about that.
Oh, really? Awesome.
Oh, sure. Yeah, of course.
So I know you're going to be headed up for bigger things next 2 weeks and better things, and you're going to love it. You're going to be on Donna's show, Cowboy Logic. They're awesome people.
Yeah, I'm thrilled about that, too. Yeah, thank you for introducing me to you know, I grew up listening to Donna, and she was on, like, every single news station for a while there. From NEW, which was a rock station,
right,
to Scott Muni, to Howard Stern.
Right.
She got fired with Howard Stern. And, like, that's like a famous event if you're in New York when Howard and Robin got fired. It was Howard, Robin, and Donna Fiducia. I mean, it's like crazy,
wow,
right? And then, yeah. And then she was anchor on Fox for a while. And her show is great,
yeah.
Cowboy Logic. It's on Facebook if you listen. I mean, it's really well – there's really cool charisma. I mean, they both exude charisma, but there's a chemistry that they both have together, which makes it feel good when you're watching it, as well as being informed.
Exactly. Yeah, they're great people. They're really good to me. She did my first interview after my book that came out in 2019, and the cool thing is I went down there to an event in South Carolina, and Don had put on my bed before I got there, because my book's an Oreo's Guide to Living, you know, an Oreo's Guide to Fitting In, you know, because I'm black, but I'm white on the inside. He actually put, you know, a package of Oreo cookies on my pillow when I got to the room. It was already done. So... they're hilarious people. They're good. They want to find out what's going on. They get to the bottom of whatever they have to. And it's a great thing that they have, they've got a TV program also, and everything simulcast to that. So you're going to have fun with them. They're great people. And I owe a lot of success to her and Don. So, but you have big things coming, and you know, that could lead to other things. They actually know Marjorie Taylor Greene, as you saw, and other people that you mentioned. Those are the people who can get you to meet these people, too. So I wish you the best of luck there.
I was so impressed that she went in there, and I just love how she's insuppressible and fearless.
Yes, she is.
When she went with Representative Gohmert, and you know, I'm not sure what was paralyzing everybody. I think it was just that everybody bought. I mean, like, I can assure everybody that I've yet to come across somebody who I say, oh, they were an insurrectionist or they were traitorous. Like, I've yet, and I'm pretty objective on this. Like, I'm actually looking for it. I'd love to find it.
Right.
These people have a deep love of the country. They have a deep love of the system. In my first filing, I did something that's a little bit too long, but I did it for a reason, because we had to really reconstruct this idea about the First Amendment and just throwing around the term, quote, extremist, unquote. And I did an exposition on that in that filing as an attempt to remind everybody about those days, you know, from the back in the late 70s, Kevin, when we used to say, no, it's, you know, you have to protect those. Nobody likes Nazis. I mean,
right.
But we all as a society and a culture agreed that they should be protected in their ridiculous expression.
And that was an Ohio State attorney who took that case, by the way.
Oh, really?
Just saying that. Go Bucks, yes. Because they brag about it at Ohio State. Hey, he took this Cody case. That's, we want to take his class. And that's, you know, that, and that meant something, too. I mean, it means a lot.
It sure did. And I remember, like, I originally was outraged that they were letting these damn Nazis march. Like, you have to get to a more sophisticated level as to why that would be a good thing as a civilization. It's not, you know, it takes work to get to that point. And here, I mean, the kind of expression that we have that I've seen is all within clearly defined boundaries of being suitable, appropriate, legal, lawful, everything. And what I'm beginning to see is that where things got out of hand, there seems to have been some bad crowd control. It was in the mix. Bad crowd control procedures, understaffing were in the mix. In some circumstances, and I'm beginning to see a trend where it may have been where you see MPD, the Metro Police Department, those guys seem to have had another mindset than the Capitol Police. This is preliminarily just looking at it, not talking as an attorney, just somebody that's been looking at the videos. And, you know, somebody at the end of the day, somebody's going to have to look at all this stuff. Forget about the criminal defense. Somebody's going to have to look at all this stuff and try to figure out what went wrong. Why did, you know, there were many protests there in the past. It wasn't people had entered Congress many times.
Right.
I believe it was the Kavanaugh hearings.
Right.
Say it again.
Hey, Brad, we got to go. But I want you to people where they can reach you. Give me your website.
Oh, sure. Where the three filings are, it's formerfedsgroup.com. And on that front page at formerfedsgroup.com, formerfedsgroup, one word, .com, at the bottom it says press release, and you'll see the most recent three filings. And we're going to start being more religious about filing those. And then for people that need legal support regarding vaccine mandates, remdesivir. We're forming up a remdesivir action group.